Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalists. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. We're going to deal with somebody today that never, ever gets dealt with amongst anybody on the right wing of any kind whatsoever. And really, certainly any nationalist, even though he deserves to be. He's a founder of something called the Austro-Marxism School. But calling it Marxist is iffy. Leon Trotsky certainly condemned it. We're talking about Otto Bauer, who was somebody who, despite himself, created a left-wing version of National Socialism, of course, without calling it that. He died in 1938 and has really been excommunicated from the Marxist movement. Austro-Marxism came into existence in the multinational world of the Austrian Empire, which was a mess of ethnicities, and therefore any kind of any ideology at all there had to take nations into existence. Otto Bauer has been almost completely forgotten. And there's good reason for that, because there's much here that would turn Strasserite on, for example. Otto Bauer wrote only a few works, but he became, along with Karl Renner, the head of that particular Austrian semi-Marxist Marxist school. There's even if on Marxist.org, there's only three essays by him, none of them having to do with ethnicity, even though that was his main concern. Once Trotsky condemned him, and of course vice versa, Bauer referred to the Soviet Union as nothing more than state capitalism. He was read out of the movement and now kind of exists in this nether region. He's not a nationalist. He's not a Marxist. He's not a liberal. He's not a socialist. He, in fact, is, what might be called, what he called himself, a national materialist, so to speak. Almost like, many of the Russian nationalists, Danilevsky and many others that we've dealt with on this show in the past. Bauer starts off, let me give you the basic thesis here. Socialism is inherently national for Bauer because what it really does, it's not this quantitative participation in labor and the methods of production. That's just a means to an end. The end is that labor is given the freedom that the upper classes presently have to enjoy and partake in and help shape the national culture. As workers, especially back then, working many, many hours, being semi-literate, how much of an impact can they have, how much enjoyment can they partake in the national culture, which is still high culture at the time? He doesn't believe in quantitative leveling whatsoever. And he calls the nation a relative community of character. People act in a certain way. It is, though, still a natural community because there is a biological descent. There is a genetic descent, which for him creates races, not nations. And the genetic inheritance, really, for him, is a biological solidification of the past, of the experience of a people that can't be wiped away by any ideology or by any circumstance. Because even something like conquest doesn't eliminate that. It's rare that a group of people is conquered and then directly occupied. They're usually conquered and then they have to pay tribute. So the core of the nation is not affected. So there's this community of, and it goes back in between genetics and culture, and how that interacts with the environment that they're in. So we saw this in Gumilev on this program many times in the past. And he says that Germans, of course he's an Austrian, that Germans, wherever they migrate, behave the same way. They bring their same language and their same way of life, although Hitler noted that the big exception to this was America. whoever goes to America becomes an American. There's something corrosive about the American life. But for Bauer, anyway, at least within Europe, wherever the Germans go, they create a German community, whether it be in Czechia or Russia or anywhere else. Culture is memory. Genetics is memory. It's not just a biological world. All ancient writers speak of ethnic differences. This isn't a new concept. But those nations weren't political entities quite yet. He makes the point that nations and families are closely connected. Siblings resemble each other, or at least resemble one of the parents or grandparents. They see themselves as related. The family helps create their character and who they are. So the core is always material in his mind, in the sense that it's genetic. But material is an eccentric way to put it, because by material he's talking about how the experiences of the past are stored in some sort of a strange Lamarckian kind of evolutionary theory. If anything, migration doesn't alter the nation, it consolidates the nation. Latin becomes this artificial language only with Roman control. His philosophy of history is different from Marxism, although he considers himself a Marxist. And the nation for him first is a tribal entity, what Karl Marx would call, classic communism or tribal communism. And only when you have settled agriculture and the split up of classes, then you have more than one culture. But Bauer says at this time, which is including his own time, when you split up the classes, the national culture, the tribal culture exists only amongst elites. Now, nationalists, especially in Eastern Europe, had disagreed with this, saying, no, it's the peasantry that's the bearer of culture, because the elites participate in an international body. They speak, Greek or Latin. And it's the peasantry. You see this in Ukraine and Romania, where the peasantry is the nation, not the elite. But Bauer disagrees and says that the national culture is to be found within elite bodies. And despite the existence of an artificial language like French or Greek or Latin, artificial in the sense that it's imposed on the elites of other nations, they still have to communicate with other classes. Classes differ from nations in the sense that they have to all interact to create a nation. So this is one big area that many nationalists would disagree in, that the peasantry has far more of a claim. However, well, in Russian history, for example, the peasantry was well aware of its cultural background, which is why the Old Believer crisis was as harsh as it was. Bauer, like so many, underestimates the peasantry, underestimates their knowledge, underestimates their literacy. But the splitting of classes splits the nations into pieces. That doesn't eliminate the nation, though. As capitalism grows, in his mind, nations grow. Because more and more of the ethnic territory has to be mobilized for production. Now, this is only the case in a few countries. It's certainly the case in France and England, not the case in Eastern Europe. And things like the Reformation make the German language the dominant one, no longer Latin. And the wealth of the church is taken by the upper classes. So as you have a unification of the national language, although you have High German and Low German, you no longer have Latin as a dominant culture, and you still, though, have greater wealth in the upper classes. Socialism is to equalize the classes, not in an economic sense, but in a cultural sense. The medieval nation, in his mind, is the elite. The peasantry, in his mind, and I do believe he's wrong in this, is acultural. But as the Old Believer movement, as a revolutionary movement in places like England show, in Ukraine, the peasantry cannot be underestimated in this regard. But the early states were, in fact, empires. They were not ethnic. But the development of capitalism, and here's another controversial concept, in his mind, it's capitalism that creates the nation, even though capitalism also creates the individual, which seems to be two completely different movements. capital demands mass education. Now, you're really talking about the 20th century now. Once the professions, doctors and lawyers, people who weren't from the knightly classes, but they also weren't peasants, the so-called middle classes, once they become educated, now the nation begins to develop, because they're not of the old knightly class speaking Latin or Greek. Peasants and low townsmen slowly become national. Educated reformers during the Enlightenment saw the nation for the first time. But even prior to that, Poland, Spain, Ireland, Greece, the Jews, all seen as nations, as communities of characters. But the modern era saw the nation of unequals become the nation of legal equals. It's a little bit like the anti-federalists in 18th century America. The promises of the Constitution would only benefit the wealthy and those who were able to secure political office, usually by bribery. That's why they rejected the Constitution. They rejected a centralized government for this very reason. But there again, we have the Whiskey Rebellion and the Freeze Rebellion and the Shays Rebellion, all of which show the American peasantry, aware of its cultural background, making war on the elite. Again, you can't underestimate the peasantry as Bauer does. Nevertheless, I understand his point of view, at least because there's two different cultures. There's an upper-class culture, even in America, where there was a speaking English, had a tendency to be Anglo-Saxon. Lower culture were more Gaelic, still speaking English, though, but often very different kinds of English. Only under the bourgeoisie, according to Bauer, do you see a real community of culture become politicized. Trade begins to be local and then expands outward. This politicized the nation because it connected people. But it connected people way beyond the borders of the nation. This is quite a self-defeating argument, but it's a very common argument. Capitalism is and Hegel had the same view, is a very transitory ideology, because it politicizes the nation. This is a part of natural development, in that as technology grows, as trade grows, the language has to become standardized. Education has to become standardized. As things become more urbanized, there's more of a sense of national belonging. In the 19th century, this wasn't an uncommon point of view. Nevertheless, there was as much anti-national focus at the time as there were national. But this is where the national movement, as a politicized version of ethnicity, begins to develop, even though it's developed certainly in the past. Russian Old Believers, Ukrainian Orthodox, Irish Catholics, going back, you know, many centuries earlier. He is correct, though, in making reference to two separate cultures that still have to interact one way or another. Capitalism spreads the national culture to more and more people. Now, the way he defines exploitation is not in economic terms. He defines exploitation as that the labor of one class becomes the culture of another class. This is what makes Bauer so interesting. Money isn't really the issue here. Control isn't the issue here. Capital is not the issue here. It's the ability to enjoy the national culture and to shape it that matters. Now, he wouldn't call himself a national socialist. This is exactly what he's talking about. Labor will control the instruments of its work. Social ownership is the same thing as national ownership. Here, the community becomes reciprocal interaction. Reciprocal interaction of equals. But of course, Proudhon said the same thing a century earlier. So socialism is the participation of the entire nation in the national life. Culture then belongs entirely to the people, not for the few who can comprehend it and who can help shape it. The nation, the community of culture, it's no longer a divided state. The private ownership of capital means a private ownership of culture, in his mind. The nation under social, and this is, you know, the Soviets always maintained that as nations provide labor with control over capital, now of course that never happened in the Soviet Union, but this was the theory that was fed to the outside, national differences will fade away. But Bauer says there's absolutely no reason to believe that. if the people can enjoy the national culture, this would solidify culture, making nations even more different from each other. And this is why Trotsky read Bauer out of the socialist movement. Socialism guarantees the unity of the nation. The greater the number of people that participate in the culture, the greater the unanimity of the will, and it becomes a community of fate, a community of justice, the common experience of the same fate. Now, this is the case certainly during wartime, but only mass warfare of the 20th century. Society is always ethnic because all classes, regardless of how artificial they might be, still have to interact with one another. To be a citizen is to enjoy the national culture, but to be a worker in the 19th century is not to be a citizen. And this is where his Marxism shows itself. So you have this community that's based both on heredity as well as experience, which forms a nation. Heredity by itself forms a race, but that's far too big to call it any kind of a community of fate. It's a community of fate because you don't choose it. You're born into it, and there's nothing you can do about it. You can't alter your genetics. You shouldn't want to alter your genetics. But the genetics really is not just this quantitative entity. It's qualitative. It's the memory of everything that your ancestors have gone through, how they've adjusted to the world over the millennia. Even intermarriage, I mean, he doesn't accept even the notion intermarriage doesn't lead to the fusion of nations because people only marry those who speak the same damn language. No one marries somebody that they don't understand. Now, in very isolated cases in high culture, you'll see this, but that's only in a handful of people. But amongst the commoners, the people who actually are the nation, although Bauer doesn't agree here, he does accept the idea that, and the German Cologne School says the same thing, that nations are, of course, objective realities because people only marry those that they can understand. Intermarriage, socialism, none of these things, even conquest, even migration, none of this leads to the equalization of nations, just the opposite. All of these lead to a great consolidation of nations. So he had three types of the national communities. I've said before, the first one is this kind of class communism, the very primitive early stages of humanity, the very beginning of settled agriculture. But once society is settled, different classes form. An upper class begins speaking differently than a lower class. Upper classes want to partake in high culture, not necessarily ethnic culture. And now Bauer has contradicted himself pretty badly here, because he is saying that the peasantry maintains the culture. The only difference is that in Eastern Europe and Northern Europe, this breaks down pretty early. Only in Catholic countries do the elite, and even this isn't the case in everywhere, do the elite speak Latin. In fact, this may be wildly exaggerated. Maybe the upper reaches of the church may speak Latin, but even then, very quickly, it becomes a liturgical language only. So even during the Renaissance, you see the fusion of languages forming nations in a much more blatant sense. For a brief period of time in the 19th century, actually the 18th century in Russia, the upper classes began speaking French, but it was so poor and artificial. Dostoevsky makes fun of them all the time for their very bad French. This attempt to, let me put it this way. If you're going to make serfs out of your own people, you can't do this unless you create a myth that, in fact, you're not the same people. This is why the Poles created the Sarmatian myth, that we descend from these nomads having nothing to do with the ordinary Pole. The aristocracy of the Poles rejected any concept of nationalism. Here you have a lower class, Slavs, and an upper class, the Sarmatians. Only much later, only when Poland collapses, when this system falls apart because it's so artificial, do you have any kind of Polish connection, only really in the 20th century, with the rebirth of Poland under Pilsudski. We've spoken about that before. So even to talk about an upper class speaking French or Latin, that is highly a great exaggeration. For the most part, they are speaking the national language, although they do differ from the lower classes. They differ in the accent. They differ in the level of concepts that are being communicated. There's no reason to educate a peasant because peasants only had to do a certain number of things. So in parts of his works, Bauer will say that the peasants are a-national. Other parts, they're in fact the consolidators of the nation. One way to save him here is to say what he's really talking about is the ability to enjoy the national culture can only be found by equal citizenship. Again, this is something that the American Anti-Federalists argued. You know, the old believers in Russia said, we are Russian culture. What Nikon, Alexis, and certainly Peter was doing was importing a foreign way of life, and that's exactly correct. So in the Russian case, you see this in Ukraine as well, you know, the cities in Ukraine were overwhelmingly foreign. This is the case in Ireland too. Here you have clearly ancient ethnic claims, and ethnicity and religion have a tendency to be very, very similar. Polish serfdom had a tendency to be the worst because in the southern parts of the empire, where they had Ukrainians as serfs. But they rejected the notion of any kind of elite nationalism. In fact, they had to form confederations to create any kind of central, temporary central government. And it certainly wasn't the monarch. So it gets complicated. But even to say that there is this artificial upper class language only exists in very brief periods of time, only in a certain number of countries, and it doesn't last very long. In Orthodox cultures, of course, the national language is always one and the same. After the Reformation in Northern Europe, the national language is one and the same. And Latin slowly but surely begins to die out. People use the vernacular for day-to-day conversations. The nation isn't really harmed that way. But only in academic studies do they use Latin. That's somewhat today is, you know, academics, we speak a different way. We don't talk like normal people. And that's how you could spot an academic a mile away, is that we're so immersed in these bizarre concepts that we don't speak like normal people. And that doesn't mean we're not part of the nation. Nations are the creation of these, and in Bauer's world anyway, of the educated middle classes. But the educated middle classes come into existence at the same time as urbanization and the rise of the bourgeoisie. Now, what Hegel does in his philosophy of right, and there's no question that Bauer is taking advantage of this, is that the civil society portion of historical development that comes from John Locke and Adam Smith, among many other people, is that nations become conscious of themselves because they have to begin corresponding one with another in the competition of global capitalism. As production becomes more and more complicated, more and more people have to be involved and more resources have to be used. More and more people need to be educated and in different ways. So the nation becomes consolidated this way. But even though it seems to promote the idea of the individual, it really doesn't. What it actually does, rather than promote the individual, is the idea that, wait a minute, I as an individual am absolutely dependent on all of these other bodies all having to speak the same language, because we all can't work in a factory together unless we're speaking the same language. We can't work in the fields together. We can't move the cities together and begin operating politically unless we all speak the same language. Nothing can be done unless you all speak the same language. Even in the Austrian Empire, if you went to Vienna, you had to speak German. This was the language of the elite language, the language of politics, because you can't have politics with several languages. It's simply not possible. But that will break down. Socialism is about sharing culture, not money. Money just provides the leisure, the professionalism. You know, capitalism is based on a small class of people that don't work. But appropriating the labor of others is nothing more than appropriating the culture of others. And he condemned Soviet Marxism and Marxism in general for being obsessed with money. No, money is a means to an end. Capital is a means to an end. It's to make life easier, so that the culture can be enjoyed. Everything from, you know, opera to literature, that even the average worker now will be able to enjoy it and know what's going on. That might be pie in the sky, but there's no doubt that he's correct in that class society makes it impossible for the lower classes to really become citizens. They just don't matter. They just don't matter, especially even today. And the worst part of American so-called democracy is that classes exist and they don't call themselves classes. The concept of class on the continent is not a matter of income. It's a matter of function. But in the Anglo-American world, class is a matter of your income and wealth. Class rule, generally speaking, refers to our different functions. All the liberal professions and the elites and peasantry all working together as equals. That's what the basic functionalist model is. But in the Anglo-American world, we refer to classes. We don't refer to title. We're not referring to corporate bodies. We're just referring to people who have money versus people who don't. And this has nothing to do with culture or ability. Even there, you know, you still had new money being condemned by old money in the Americas. But to the extent that socialism wins, legitimate socialism, not Soviet socialism, not state capitalism, but something along the lines of what Tito tried to do in Yugoslavia, where he actually did try to put labor in control of capital. Enforcing that, by the way, was always very difficult, because no one wants to go to a planning meeting after putting in 8 hours. In fact, there's something to be said for though you make less money than your manager, the manager still has to stay a lot later than you do. Nevertheless, this was the, and this is what frightened the Soviet Union, that they almost got invaded for this. That no, we cannot promote the idea that socialism has anything to do with labor, because in the Soviet Union it didn't. It had to do with the rule of one class, this very Judaic overlordship. But Tito was different. Yugoslavia was not liberated by the Soviet army. I mean, there's some myth to that, but generally speaking, it wasn't. And the result is that they developed their own path. Now, Bauer died long before Tito came to power. Not too long. But Bauer's idea made a lot more sense in Yugoslavia, which, by the way, is very similar to Austria, and that is a hodgepodge of nations. Serbia is a lingua franca, only because Serbia was the only country in Yugoslavia that had a tradition of independence. Same thing for Germany. In Austria, Germany made up a bare majority of people and had the best educational system and had what was clearly a highly efficient and humane bureaucracy. Anyway, nation is the social means by which a person can come into existence. I didn't say an individual. An individual is an abstraction of industrialization. Industrialization is a separate issue. This is created by imperialism because the capital that is necessary to create huge industrial enterprises has to come from overseas colonies. No country has that much excess resources. We're not talking about this. We're talking about general commerce. And even there, we're only talking about a couple of countries. We're only talking about Germany in the 20th century. We're talking about the Netherlands and England. Because really, it wasn't until the 20th century even France became an industrialized country. World War I, France was still an agricultural society. But each person, regardless of their status in society, is the product of a nation. The nation has to be the sum of individuals, but that's divided and made artificially separate by the existence of classes. The reason why he talks about, you know, medieval lords being the nation is not that they're the sole bearers of culture. They're the only ones who have the means to enjoy it and to shape it. Peasants weren't citizens. Being a citizen is to be a legal equal in the political ideology, the general culture of a people. It's harder to follow than just money, which is all Karl Marx ever cared about. He never spoke of the national culture. What was to hold these new societies together, if not the genetic inheritance and the environment of the nation? Marxism was purely negative. Bauer says, no, that's only one side of the story. The positive side of the story is why do we worry about capital so much? We worry about capital so much because we're talking about culture. Expropriation is the expropriation of cultural resources from the peasantry that can only be enjoyed and altered and mainstreamed by a handful of people. Now, in the United States, which is something that I think Bauer was vaguely aware of, there is no high culture at all. It's been so vulgarized while still maintaining a class society, which means it's an artificial mass culture designed to mask the fact that that the Americans live in the most, you know, advanced, class system of all. But because they don't have titles are technically illegal, according to the Constitution, everyone's supposed to be a legal equal. And we all know that that's absurd, because classes in America have everything to do with wealth and the power that it creates, not function. Nations can't exist without a common language. The community in the nation is a substratum of all communication. Nothing can happen. I don't care what era you're talking about, what period of time you're talking about. Nothing can happen socially unless all classes are able to communicate one with another. The Roman Catholic doctrine attempts to destroy nations by placing the papacy, at least in theory, in charge of the politics and economics of all nations, bringing them within one cosmopolitan order. But even Roman cosmopolitanism was highly artificial. It was based on the Latin language. National character derives from the interaction with others. But that interaction is mediated by culture and language, by genetics, by experience, and by the environment. Class society has broken up the original unity of the tribe. The tribe is the core of any nation. And they come and go just like individuals do, just like families do. It doesn't mean they don't retain a specific genetic background that stays more or less stable over time. Change is very, very slow. Bauer is not anti-religious like Marxism is, because it notices, especially in Eastern Europe, and of course being Austrian, he knew of Eastern European life very well, that religion was the unified language of the people. To speak Ukrainian, say in 17th century Ukraine, to speak Polish and or Latin was to be Roman Catholic, to speak Ukrainian was to be Orthodox. These weren't just religious markers, they were national and ethnic markers, they were even genetic markers. So in the religious wars between Catholic and Orthodox in 17th century Ukraine, even before that, at the Union of Brest in 1595, you have battle of two ethnicities. There is no such thing as a Ukrainian Catholic. Like it or not, the entire Ukrainian identity came into existence really as a fight against the Unions. How bizarre that in the 20th century the Unions are the focal point of the vulgar Ukrainian nationalist in communion with the Roman See. I find that bizarre because it goes completely against what the Union was. The Union was a gateway to Polish culture. It was a way to make the country Polish and destroy the Orthodox Church as a means of rebellion, as a foundation for rebellion against the lordship of the Poles and the Jews, who, of course, 80% of the world's Jews were living in the Polish Empire at the time. Differences in religion lead to two nations, not one. There is no nation with two separate religions. This is why the Kaiser, really even prior to the Bismarckian state, needed to throw the Catholics out of Germany. He was being consistent, at least. Old Catholics were not affected. The same thing goes for Poland. The idea that Catholicism is a cosmopolitan body vehemently went against the national idea. The popes eventually accepted that it couldn't really create a unified cosmopolitan world, and so created concordats with local states. And so you did have such a thing as a Catholic nation, but not because the Pope wanted it that way. It was a compromise, a papal compromise in this sense. And that's what a concordat is a way to say, well, we are a universal force, but we recognize that we cannot control a national culture, but just take us seriously as a international body. And this is why the priesthood was always unmarried and separate and speaking Latin. Now, I personally don't think that nations can come out of capitalism. States certainly do. But Bauer, unlike Mussolini, and it's the reason why I dislike fascism as an ideology, Mussolini made no distinction between nation and state. We talked about this on this show before. He weakens later on in his career, but the notion that not only is the state the nation, but the state is identical to the nation becomes the watchword of Italian fascism. The state comes into existence to protect at least the elite of the national body at first. But it doesn't mean it's all that the state's capable of. Bauer's whole ideology is based around the fact that the state is a shell. It protects and encapsulates a certain culture and a certain group of people. As more and more people are brought into the mainstream of society through socialism, that shell gets filled up. And the nation becomes more and more consolidated with more and more people becoming loyal to it. Because once you're able to enjoy it and direct its future, you have a reason to be loyal to it. Otherwise, it's an alien imposition. The anti-federalists in the United States, the old believers in Russia, made this exact same claim. There are now two nations. Sage Rebellion said the same thing. There's this federalist overclass in the cities and the anti-federalist underclass in the countryside. They're not supposed to be two nations. But the underclass was never actual citizens. They were persecuted. States certainly come out of capitalism. States may even come out of industrialization. But only to the extent that states can facilitate internationalism, or at least the existence of empires. It drives me crazy when people talk about World War I as a result of nationalism. No, it's the result of imperialism. The Marxists were correct on that one. Nations were swallowed up by imperial entities. Therefore, the whole notion, the reason why imperialism is such a problem, is that it destroys nations. If it didn't destroy nations, then why is it a problem at all? If nations don't exist, then imperialism is not a problem. So Trotsky says that this doctrine is not revolutionary. In other words, it's not Jewish enough for him. Otto Bauer was at least partially Jewish. So Trotsky reads him out of Marxism and out of Judaism, saying no Jew can support Gentile nationalism as Bauer did. And that so-called Austro-Marxist school was not revolutionary. And that he is anti-Soviet and his people will be sent to camps. And Bauer responds to this, as I've said before, by saying the Soviet Union is nothing more than state capitalism. The Soviets are creating a state such that even Russia doesn't exist anymore. They're not equalizing culture. They're giving the party elite status. Now, the other aspect of Bauer's theory, another thing that's quite non-Marxist about him, is that he was anti-rationalization. When he says rationalization, he's talking about quantity. He's talking about positivism, empiricism, the core of industry, the rule of numbers, the obsession with efficiency. When you obsess about efficiency, poetry has to disappear because poetry knows nothing about efficiency. People talk about poetry and they say, well, just say it already. Well, no, that's not what poetry is. This is not about using few words. Few words alter the message. Nations are poetic. States are prosaic. Capital is prosaic, although they need not be. Really, the final goal of socialism, although socialists rarely talk about this, Marx certainly never did. The goal of socialism is that capital is owned by the entire national culture such that no one really needs to work 15 hours a day to make a living. Because the massive productive capacity is put to the needs of the people rather than to the elites, you hardly need to work at all. For some strange reason, it never took place in the Soviet Union. It didn't take place in Yugoslavia. And they had a million excuses as to why that is. So the nation is based on personality, not efficiency, not on the state. The nation is a product of history in two separate ways. There's the material content, or the genetic content, then the economic content, the forces of production, which in a Hegelian sense, when a nation is slowly being unified in civil society, in the development of capitalism, the development of markets, the individual isn't released. The individual is starting increasingly seen as time goes on as artificial, because the individual then becomes dependent on the functionality of the nation as a whole. So socialism means the integration of citizenry within a singular national culture, which of course includes religion. Now, Thouwer makes a strange claim in his debates with Karl Kautsky, that culture precedes language. Now, I find that a very strange thing to say. And it really has to do with how you define language. When I use the term language, the way nationalists use the term, we're not just talking about words. We're talking about all forms of communication, which ends up being all forms of tradition. That's all that is. Words are only a tiny aspect of how we communicate one with another. But when you rationalize society, words are all that is. This is what was so destructive about the Protestant Reformation, that it takes these highly edited books of the Bible and makes it the Word of God. There is no more Christian culture because it has to do with works. It's true that it liberated the German language. That is true. But that it took Christian culture and made it simply a matter of words and absolutely nothing else. But we know one thing. We know that words are very weak. Words don't express what we want them to. If that were the case, then describing your vacation in Barbados would be identical with actually being in Barbados. Well, obviously it's not, because words are very weak. They can only describe little bits and pieces of it, and we can picture it in our minds in a very weak way. That's as close as words can get. This is why nations are so important, because a national culture is a tradition which is identical with the language. So I disagree with Thouwer in that sense. But this is in a polemic with Karl Kautsky. I mean, the Austro-Marxist school fought with every other branch of Marxism. And the other thing he fought, and this is what drove Trotsky insane, anyone who drives Trotsky insane is a friend of ours, I think, the notion that nationalism is nothing more than a cover for economic rule. Thouwer fought that concept. It's a complete falsity, because the nation is equalitarian by its very structure. There is nothing keeping all people from participating in the culture. In fact, cosmopolitanism today is the ideology of capital, not the nation. There was never a time, especially in industrialization, where the nation was the focus of capital. Today, all capitalism is international. And so the nation is all that's left as far as revolution is concerned. What else can you put up against globalism if not the nation? What is large enough? What is powerful enough? What is so comprehensive enough? What has the history that the nation has? For Thouwer, race is too great. That is strictly the community of fate in the sense of pure genetic backgrounds. It's too big. Now, in places like the United States or with the migration crisis in Europe, race has been shoved down our throats. That's not what he's talking about. He's talking about it in a theoretical sense. So it turns out that Thouwer has more in common with Immanuel Kant than he does with Karl Marx. Because Kant assumes that all human beings are rational, which is a wild assumption, and therefore can conceive of universal truth, another wild assumption. Because of that, human beings therefore have to be seen as ends, because they embody the infinite. Not in a divine sense. In an intellectual sense. This is why Thouwer takes the nation so seriously. There is no reason why everybody, not necessarily is rational, because reason is limited in his mind. But there's no reason why everyone can't participate in the culture. In that sense, they are ends. What are means is, in fact, economic life, capital, trade. That's not an end in of itself, but you wouldn't know that talking about to Marxists about it. Culture and language are one and the same in the sense that language is, in fact, the tradition of a people. If you reduce language to just words and phrases, then, of course, he's right. Because words and phrases that are shared by people have to have a common foundation. And that common foundation, as Herder would tell us, is the tribe. The nation is the most egalitarian concept you could think of. Because culture is something that has to be shared by large numbers of people, including different classes. The problem that Bauer has isn't so much that workers can't be a part of culture, it's just that they don't have the time or the education. When you're working 15 hours a day, when you're raising a family, when you're worried about mundane concerns, when are you going to be able to study opera? Socialism, though, holds out the promise that that can be the case. He makes matters worse for his communist allies by talking about fascism. He says this. He says, after World War I, there was this equalization of classes. I should say an equilibrium of classes in a lot of European states. Now, when the Depression hit in 1929, that changed. Karl Marx did talk about the notion of Bonapartism. That is what happens when a revolution begins to sputter out and the strong man takes over. This is why it's named after Napoleon. Trotsky saw Stalin as a Bonapartist for that reason. Bauer says that fascism was anti-bourgeois, which of course it was. In no way did this protect the capitalist classes. The capitalist classes fought fascism with every bone in their body. Fascism meant economic planning. You either were on board or you went to prison. We talked about this in Korea, Indonesia, the Third World, everywhere. That's how it was. And Trotsky was fuming when Bauer said this, because Trotsky's view was that fascism and nationalism in general is a disguise for economic interest. The elite talks about the unity of all of our people in one culture, which is meant to disguise the disunity in terms of culture. Bauer is aware of this. That doesn't mean that that's all that nationalism is. Nationalism is the end. The economic theory is the means. Social and political domination are two very different things. So fascism comes from three separate forces. First of all, veterans returning from World War I. This is a déclassé force. Now, most Marxists don't believe that there is any such thing as a déclassé individual. But Bauer disagrees with them on this too. That returning veterans from war were a firmly nationalist force that wanted nothing to do with Marxism. Two, peasant farmers and small business, including the liberal professions. And number three, very limited capital support. And there he's talking about small and at most medium-sized capital. Capital had no difficulty functioning in the Soviet Union. I've said this many times before. I have a book coming out on the Barnes Review Press on the USSR. Some of you have it already. Showing that's exactly the case. I mean, it was simply state capitalism. The Communist Party sucked the cultural and the economic excess only for itself. It actually called itself the workers' movement, even though most of them had never worked a day in their lives. The conflict with capitalism, and Bauer is screaming this to people like Trotsky, is that fascist societies have planned economies. Fascist societies have taken over the private control of the banks. So you tell me, Mr. Trotsky, who has refused to nationalize the Bank of New York in Moscow, tell me how fascism isn't revolutionary in that sense. Now, he condemns fascism in general, but not for these reasons. It's definitely not. I mean, if you read the work of Bauer in the 1920s, fascism to him really is, you know, this Strassite revolutionary idea. But once 1929 hits, and you have this massive credit crunch, capital becomes discredited. And now the state steps in with credit, with jobs, with support. And it has to do this either in favor of business or opposed to it. And generally was opposed to it because businesses don't take kindly to being taken over. Banks don't take kindly to having generals being put in the position of chief banker, like you had in Burma, for example, and even in China today. So Bauer is saying fascism is far from the last cry of capitalism. It's nothing of the sort. The worst it is Bonapartism. Because in each fascist government, you have one man, whether military or quasi-military, that takes the reins of all forms of power, social, political, and economic. But big businesses don't go along with this. There's absolutely nothing capitalist about this. And this is what, among many other things, that got Trotsky fuming and Lenin fuming at him. And this is why very few of you have ever heard of Austro-Marxism. Only specialists in the field are aware of it. And even in Marxist pages, these guys either don't know who these guys are or deliberately keep them out. There are a few articles on Marxism.org, or I'm sorry, Marxist.org, I think it is, Renner and Bauer, but they're not on ethnicity. But Bonapartism essentially is what happens, and Karl Marx does talk about this, is when revolution destroys the pillars of society such that the only thing that's left is the military to be able to take over. So you see this in the Third World, where because of imperialism, traditional culture has been destroyed. Well, without the prop of foreign government, what happens? Well, the traditions aren't strong enough to rule the society. The ruling class is often foreign, in Africa and Asia, usually foreign educated to begin with. They still are. And the only real focused, national, rational, strong armed force is the military. And they have a tendency to be very popular. So in the Third World, you have military governments everywhere for this very reason. The revolutions in Europe swept away the old order, like in France, but didn't have anything to replace it with. So you had Napoleon. And Bauer says, why don't Marxists take this seriously? It's not a bad thing. It's a necessary thing. Socialism is not anti-national. This is a strictly, and this is as a man who's at least partially Jewish, thinking this is a Jewish concept. The destructive nature of people like Trotsky is to reject any nation, the Jewish one. He will not be a part of this. Nations are revolutionary entities. It's not even to say that sometimes they aren't used as covers for economic power. Maybe they are. You see it in America once in a blue moon, where cosmopolitan corporations begin talking about patriotism. But Bonapartism is what happens when you have a purely negative revolution. And of course, Bauer is alive during Stalin's reign. So Russian culture has been driven underground, destroyed, or sent abroad. Making matters worse, Stalin purges the party of the early elites. So what does he have left but himself and military force? So of course he's a Bonapartist. Any revolution has this problem. The difference between Bonapartism in the Soviet Union and in Central Europe, or even Western Europe, is that 1929, well, two things, the shock of World War I and the crash of 29, discredited capitalism and liberal democracy, which in Bauer's eyes was perfectly fine. He's not going to deny that Hitler was successful. He's not going to deny that fascists were anti-bourgeois. And what they started doing is taking issues away from the left. But Trotsky begins calling Stalin a Bonapartist, trying to use Marxist theory to make sense out of him. Now, all he meant by that was saying that once the Jewish element, now again, Stalin was surrounded by Jews. He was not a Jew himself, but was surrounded by them. but the early Bolsheviks were strictly Jewish. That doesn't mean he was anti-Jewish. It just meant he didn't like competition. He simply had a new generation of Jews surround him. But Bonapartism was a way of calling Stalin a fascist. And so Trotsky backed himself into a corner. If fascism is Bonapartism, wouldn't that make fascism revolutionary? And as far as I could tell, people like Kautsky and Lenin and Trotsky had no answer to this. Western capital built the USSR. This is not lost on Otto Bauer. Western capital had free rein of Soviet labor. Capitalism, of course, was imported into the Soviet Union. This is the only way that they could create their electric grid, their heavy industry. They didn't have those resources normally. Not after the war, not after the revolution, they certainly didn't. Trotsky makes a stupid claim by saying that it's the collective will of the working class that created industrialization. He knows that's stupid. That's such a mystification, and he's aware of this. Stalin got so worried about the massive amount of Western capitalist influence in the Soviet Union that he thinks that the party could be eclipsed, that the independence of the USSR is going to be threatened by this. Fascists turned out to be far more revolutionary than the Stalinists, because the fascists were continually at war with capital. That was not the case with foreign capital in the Soviet Union. So when all said and done, Bauer is to be taken seriously. Austro-Marxism isn't really Marxism. It talks about socialism, but only as a general sense of equal citizenship and having equal control over the economic resources of the nation, but for the purpose, the further purpose, of enjoying the national culture, which is worth enjoying and worth preserving. There is nothing retrograde about the national culture because it is an equalitarian institution. This is something that Herder made very clear. Fascism's problem and Bonapartism's problem is that it denies the existence of the nation. I mean, Italy, it kind of makes sense. You have Sicily, you have southern Italy, you have northern Italy. Three very different places. You didn't have an Italian nation in the 1920s. Even today, you still have a strong separatist movement in the northern cities. You always have. You have the Lombard League, you know, in the Middle Ages. I mean, this is nothing new. The other example of this is France, where Bonapartism was created. You have many different nations in France that were forcibly fused together. It doesn't mean it's not a legitimate French culture, but there is a bit of artificiality to it. In order for the nation to compete with others, it had to consolidate its forces around the French language. So Bonapartism has something to do with the fact that the nations that they came into existence to rule over were not unified entities. Quite the contrary. Anyway, Otto Bauer should be read. His stuff is hard to find. But this is a Strasserite approach to Marxism that I think should be taken very seriously. Thank you for listening, everybody. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalist with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson and RadioArian.com.